We've got a great episode of This Week in Law coming up for you with Megan Carpenter, Zian Tang, and Carrie O'Shea Gorgone. We're going to be hands-free in our Tesla live stream and sports, and lots more next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson, episode 302, recorded May 8th, 2015. The first rule of Livestream Club. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution that can help your law firm and any small business save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so glad you are here. We have an excellent panel of folks with us to discuss the issues that have been on our minds at the intersection of technology and law this week. One issue is a carryover from last week, where we talked a lot about the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight and what was going to happen the day after we recorded the show. We now know what happened. And in fact, we have joining us this week the author of our resource of the week from last week, and that is Carrie O'Shea Gorgone. And Carrie, great to see you.
Thanks for having me, Denise.
Wonderful to have you. Carrie is a writer and a podcaster. She does the Marketing Smarts podcast for marketing profs, and she writes What Marketers Need to Know. And that's one of her pieces there that we highlighted last week on live streaming. And you've been getting a lot of attention this week over that analysis. We saw you on the NBC Nightly News as well.
I have. I attribute it all to SEO. Can't imagine awesome. How else it happened.
Yes. If you doubted whether Carrie knew about marketing, now you know.
Yes. I hate to say I told you so, but.
Also joining us from Texas A&M School of Law, we have Megan M. Carpenter. Megan teaches IP law and various technology-related laws over in Texas, but is joining us today from DC. Hello, Megan.
Hi, Denise. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful to see you. Thanks so much for joining us. And also joining us is Zian Tang. She's a lawyer at Arndt Fox and has written and studied and analyzed all kinds of interesting things. It's a pleasure to meet you, Zian.
Really great to be here, Denise.
All right, so I think we will start off the show talking about the fight now that we know what happened with Periscope and Meerkat. So if you tuned in last week, I was very interested. In fact, many of our panelists last week hadn't really even known that the fight was going to happen. It just wasn't on their radar. It was on my radar because I was wondering quite anxiously what was going to go on the piracy front for this fight, because it was such a big media event. It had so much hype. There was so much money on the line, not just for the fighters, but for the promoters, for the people who attended the fight, who paid exorbitant amounts for tickets. So it really was quite a perfect storm for people to share the fight with others who maybe couldn't pay all that money to attend or watch via pay-per-view. It was about $100 to watch on pay-per-view. And so we thought that maybe live streaming would be a big deal. And Carrie thought too when she wrote up her piece before the fight. And I don't think anybody really realized, I certainly didn't, how big a deal it was going to be. It turned out to be a very big deal. We've got a lot of stories in our discussion points that if folks want to read in detail, you can go to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/302. Many, many folks wrote up their experiences, one in particular at Mashable, watching the show online, on Periscope in particular, and what an interesting experience that was, how easy it was to find live streams of the fight, how at one point she was on a stream that had over 10,000 viewers. We learned after the fact as well unsurprisingly, Periscope received a number of takedown requests, a pretty small number, actually, I thought, only 66 while the fight was going on. And they took down 30 streams with great alacrity. I'm not sure what their response time was, but I think they took down the streams while the fight was still airing. So all of this definitely was a big deal. It seemed like the concern that we talked about last week of, you know, is this really going to be a thing where people are pointing their phones at a TV? Could that be a good viewing experience? Turns out it wasn't half bad. And there's sort of a social aspect of it, too, that enhances the viewing experience. And as my husband, the big sports fan, pointed out, actually pointing a phone at the TV might give viewers a better experience than if someone held up their phone in the fight and streamed it live, because if you're streaming the TV coverage, you're getting all, you know, the professional camera angles and the commentary and everything else, even if it is a little jerky and fuzzy. And every now and then the phone turns from the TV to show the attendees in someone's living room. So Carrie, were you surprised by how big a deal this was?
No. I mean, there's two things you can count on with a new technology, is that people are going to find a way to use it illegally. And usually first that's the porn people, but in this case it was the copyright infringers, I guess, that went for it first. I guess if I was surprised at all, it was just that people had that level of patience to hold the phone in front of their HD TV for that long. I would get tired. My arms would get tired. Maybe that's a new use for the selfie stick, to help you hold it up so you can like pirate live streams of stuff. But with an HD TV, I mean, it ended up looking pretty darn good. You know, and I have a lot of sympathy actually for Periscope in that situation, because it's like whack-a-mole. You know, as soon as they would get one feed shut down, another one would spring up. The one that had 10,000 views actually was watching on an HD TV. So that's like a better view than people would get probably on some of their own TVs at home. So no, not surprising, disappointing. And I think it's got ramifications for the industry going forward. I wonder how many of the people who watched it that way would ever have purchased it anyway, though. So as far as lost revenue, I'm not convinced that many of those people were going to pay money. I think it was more like they could, so they did.
Right. It seems like over time that will get worse, though, right? Because if this becomes a thing where some people who get the pay-per-view will then share it through a streaming service, others might consciously decide not to get the pay-per-view because they know they're going to have another alternative. It might not be the best alternative, but it's good enough for them, and they get to have the live participation in the event that otherwise they wouldn't. It's Christine.
I was just going to say, the people that own the rights to broadcast those streams are in a difficult position, though, because if you want to come down on the people who are sharing it, obviously they did buy it because they have it to share. So you're coming down on the people who are supporting your business model. It's almost like copyright, when they talked about Napster and how they went after people for downloading music illegally, and they started arresting people, and it got very ugly. I think they're going to have to figure out a new way to monetize those kinds of events that doesn't involve, you know, prosecuting people who live stream it, because they're just going to. That's what I think.
Right. It was Christina Warren at Mashable who wrote up her experiences attempting to watch the fight via live stream. Carrie, did you experiment with that at all, having known that the streams would be available?
No.
No.
No, I'm a lawyer. Are you kidding me? I was like, I'm going to file somewhere if I start watching some kind of content like that on Periscope. Like, I just know. I first became aware of it actually when Game of Thrones premiered for this season, and I knew at that point that we were looking at just straight copyright infringement there. This is a little different because it's a live event, so you maybe have some interest in showing your experience there, but the people who just kept it on the TV the whole time, I didn't want any part of that.
Right. And if you read Christina Warren's coverage and some of the other coverage, they're obviously live streaming in an unauthorized way. A fight isn't a new thing just with the advent of Periscope and Meerkat. There have been unauthorized streams of other fights around for some time. But apparently the social aspect, Christina thought, really added a dimension that had its own value. And it's very interesting from a business standpoint. with Twitter, trying to position itself as a partner to big media companies, but then having Dick Costolo and Chris Sacca come out and give some pretty self-congratulatory tweets that they have been backpedaling from ever since about who the actual winner of the fight was, it being Periscope in their mind, which has been taken to mean, gee, you know, you did well because people were streaming the fight and weren't authorized to do that. But, you know, they have been since saying, they and others involved in Periscope have been saying, oh, no. We, you know, it was a great experience. All the legal ways that Periscope was being used around the fight were just wonderful. And we're seeing the future of how sports will be promoted and experienced in those legal uses as well. So that's
Honey, that's not what you thought it was. You know, you're not seeing what you think you're seeing. Give me a break. We all know what they meant. And I think we're seeing a lot of what happened with Google and YouTube, the same thing where you want to be the media darling, and yet you're costing the traditional media companies millions of dollars. You're not going to be best friends anymore. So we're going to have that problem. You know, Twitter's going to have that problem. Now that they've embraced Periscope and even endorsed its use, however tacitly in that way, I think they're not going to make any new friends for sure. And they might lose some of the ones they had.
Well, we're fortunate that we have an IP law professor with us here today to talk about the IP law that applies to all of this. Live streaming changes things a bit from the traditional YouTube type experience, doesn't it, Megan?
It certainly does. And in fact, the idea of a Periscope or Meerkat was something that I used for years on a copyright exam, just sort of putting that out there in a live streaming context. And now that it exists, I have to think of some new questions. But there are a couple of different IP issues that I see coming out of this situation. With the copyright issues, it's interesting because copyright has such a low bar for copyrightability, and I think this is going to impact some of the other things we'll talk about today. But one of those is fixation. Live performances are not necessarily subject to copyright, although something like this certainly would be because it is simultaneously recorded under the authority of the copyright holder. So when we look at kind of fair use and what's fair about the streaming and in the discussion that we've just been having over the last few minutes, it seems like we're trying to make a distinction between someone kind of holding, their phone up to a high definition television and then maybe showing more of a social experience. So it seems like even in our discussion, we're trying to kind of figure out what might be fair about this and what might not be fair. And one of the things that's really important to remember is that when we think about the effect on the market, it's not just the existing market of people who, you know, would purchase the rights to view the fight, but also potential licensing markets. So, you know, the potential market. And so that's, you know, thinking about different revenue models and perhaps different tiers of revenue models that might come out of something like this could impact the whether or not it's fair use. I think it's interesting when Carrie mentioned the phrase whack-a-mole. I think that's very much on point. It seems to be a phrase that gets bandied about a lot in situations like this. And for me, that's always a signal that that we might need to be looking at new business models. And then I always feel a little bit sorry for whomever owns the trademark for the phrase whack-a-mole, because it seems to be used so much with new technologies. But something that I think is interesting with regard to the copyright issues is that under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the kinds of takedown notices that were contemplated in the DMCA, as modern as words like digital or millennium might seem, have really become very much outdated in the last few years. And the takedown isn't as instantaneous as these particular models seem to require. So not all of those, there just isn't enough time in a fight like this to send a notice and make sure that each of those streams is getting removed as quickly as possible. And we don't really have a sense, I think, in the law about what is too long to wait to take something down. I mean, we know that, I think there's a case saying that 7 months is too long. But that kind of need for kind of an instant reaction is something that our copyright law really just isn't equipped to handle right now.
Right. And we actually have a case pending right now. I wasn't aware of this case until this morning and getting ready for the show. But our friend Professor Goldman wrote it up back in January. And in January of this year, there was a summary judgment motion. The case involves Ustream, and they're being sued by Square Ring, who put on or was the promoter behind a fight in 2009. It was the Roy Jones Jr. and Omar Shelka fight. And they sent some notices to some DMCA takedown notices to Ustream, who responded and took the offending streams down within 48 hours. So what happened here is Ustream moved for summary judgment, saying, look, we did everything we were supposed to do under the DMCA, so there should not be a lawsuit against us, and tried to get the court to buy in on that. And the court didn't grant the summary judgment. Instead, it's sending this case to trial, and it will happen somewhere down the road here in Delaware. This is pending in a federal court in Delaware. And the thing where the court got hung up was in the alacrity of the response time. Whether the court was not ready to say, as a matter of law, that 48 hours was fast enough. The court's going to let a trial happen on that and the other issues in the case. Which when Professor Goldman wrote this up, his take seems to be, well, 48 hours is pretty darn fast. He's concerned about this being a jury trial potentially for Ustream, and having a hard time convincing a jury that internet companies can't make copyright infringing activity magically disappear at no cost with zero turnaround time. It's actually quite a process if you're going to try and respond to all the takedown requests. And again, I think 66 for this fight, that seemed like a really low number to me. That in future for big events, I think we could expect to see many, many more requests happening in real time. So this case is pending. We don't know what's going to happen with it. We don't know if there's going to be litigation over what happened last Saturday with the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight either. So far, there does not seem to be. And Twitter and Periscope have been busy saying, you know, copyright infringement is not our thing. You know, we're going to try and put tools in place that will make it easy for rights holders to get unauthorized streams taken down as they're happening. So we'll just have to wait and see what they do about that. But this case about the 09 fight will be interesting to see how it comes out. Zian, have you been paying attention to this? And do you have any thoughts about the future of live events and live streaming?
Definitely. I was actually out of town the night the fight was happening, but I remember everyone really wanted to hurry out of this wedding that we were attending to go to a bar to actually watch the fight. And of course, the bar was charging a giant cover to even be able to get inside and watch the fight. So I think what we're seeing right now is this sort of premium that's being placed on of the moment events. And this is not something obviously that's just relegated to sports, but if you think about music concerts and fashion shows and anything else that is contingent on either buying a ticket to be at the actual event or else paying to view it on pay-per-view or something like that. So I agree with what has been said in terms of how the DMCA is just not a very good tool, because by the time, you know, I mean, 40 is 48 hours fast enough when probably the only, you know, the people who really want to actually watch it are going to be watching it as it happens in real time. And I think part of what I thought of when this entire thing with Periscope came up was just sort of the similarities to Aereo, and how Aereo was this new upstart technology that got shut down pretty quickly by the broadcasters, who had definitely an interest in getting a lot of revenue from live sports, which is, I think, one of the most cited reasons, like the Super Bowl, obviously one of the most cited reasons for paying for television. And, you know, it's something that could take a really big hit from live streaming like Periscope.
From a business model standpoint, Megan, we were talking a bit before the show about how some live streaming companies save the streams and allow you to access them after the actual event has taken place. Periscope does so for 24 hours, I think. Others have different policies about that. Do you think that there's a better strategy to pursue if you are one of those companies? Maybe you'd not want to have things lingering around that could be infringing after the fact?
Mm-hmm. I do think so, that the DMCA might treat it differently depending upon how long these things are cached. In order to qualify for the exceptions under the DMCA for being an online service provider, you know, some of those are impacted by, you know, whether or not these things are actually, they're things that are stored on the system of the particular company. So the thing that I find particularly interesting about this is that, you know, that they're not stored for any length of time, and that it happens so fast that I don't know that it's possible or feasible to use the provisions of the DMCA and the takedown notices. I just don't think that the DMCA is built to accommodate that. So I think that the more we get to kind of instantaneous live action, not stored events, that really calls into account the flaws of the current copyright law.
Well, I think I'll throw this question at our marketer on the show today. What do you think, Carrie, from a marketing and PR standpoint? We've been talking about liability for the live stream services themselves, but I think it was you or Megan who mentioned earlier that there's certainly precedent for going after users too. Do you think that we'll see a resurrection of that kind of approach or not?
I really hope not. I do think copyright law needs to be revisited, modernized. But one of the things they need to consider is the way people use technology now has changed the way they consume content. And that's not, we're not going back. You know, just like they had to adjust to the first paradigm shift with music and live performances, you know, they've got to shift again now and figure out what they're going to do with the fact that people are going to live stream this stuff. I mean, the people who paid the most money to watch that fight are the people who bought tickets and sat there. So if they mm-hmm. chose to stream, you could kick them out, right? You had something you could immediately do. Or if you really wanted to be hardcore, you could shut off, like make it so phones didn't work in the arena or something. People would freak out. But let's leave that aside. You have control to a degree over those people. But once it's out there and people are doing this from their homes all over the world, I think one stream was coming from a police department in Africa. It's, I'm not going to say hopeless, but it's kind of a fool's errand to try to shut down all of those feeds while they're happening. I really think that from a business standpoint, they're going to have to find another way to monetize, whether that's selling licensed, you know, DVDs of the fight later on. Does anybody use DVDs anymore? No. I just dated myself, or merchandise or something. I just think they're going to have to think as marketers and PR people a little more broadly before you try to just come down on the people who are actually paying for the stuff.
Our chat room always corrects me when I say I don't use DVDs and says there are lots of people who still do. So don't feel bad. I tweeted at Christina Warren after she published her piece at Mashable and asked if any of the streams she was seeing as she was monitoring it live during the fight were coming from the arena. And she said she heard about one or two, but she didn't find any of those. But I don't know if any of you saw the photographs of the audience of the fight that was in all the sports pages, you know, the next morning. Gosh, now that's archaic, the sports page the next morning. I'm sure a lot of those photos were online that night. And what universally caught my eye was all of those folks in the seats at the fight holding up their phones, you know, taking pictures, etc. I wonder, you know, if a lot of that could go on during the fight. I'm sure the person behind you wouldn't like it too much if your phone were in their way, but there were just, you know, very it's certainly very accessible for folks sitting in an arena like that to go ahead and live stream if that's what they're inclined to do.
I think that's the difference with Meerkat and Periscope. What makes it different from everything we've seen before is the immediacy of it, how easy it is to do it. And I think that mm-hmm. a lot of people aren't even considering, never mind the people who are holding it up to their TV, but I don't know that they're doing the analysis in their head, like, this is wrong, I'm costing people money, I'm breaking the law. It's just like, hey, I can do this, boom. And because we can, we do.
Right. Well, let's go back to Megan for a second, because you touched on something, Megan, about fixation. And the fact that although people who put on live sporting events will put on their tickets and, you know, their otherwise enforceable terms of service, that thou shalt not live stream, that might not technically be against copyright law. Am I right about that?
That might be true. Mm-hmm. I have some experience in the world of professional wrestling. So there may be not personal experience in professional wrestling, but with the legal issues involved in professional wrestling. And so there might be some forms of sports or entertainment that that are choreographed and sketched out. But in general, it's not a particular performance of something that has been fixed in advance. And so that in a way presents challenges for copyrightability. However, if there are particular recordings that are being made of a performance at the time and that are being transmitted, there are special caveats in the Copyright Act to accommodate the reproduction of those performances.
Right. Well, I think this is all still unfolding, and it's going to be really interesting to see how it goes. You know, we have folks that are going to continue to do things like live stream a home run by Billy Butler at an Oakland A's game, which is something that has been done, you know, by folks involved in these companies and thinking that they're perfectly fine in doing so. But maybe we're going to find...
It's not even mainstream yet, Denise. It's not even mainstream. It's like some tiny percentage of people even know what Periscope and Meerkat are. Just wait.
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, as things move off our phones and onto our persons as well, Google Glass, maybe not the best example, but in one of these pieces that are in our discussion points for today, and they're all good. I encourage people to, you know, they're all pretty long, but if you have time, go through and read them, because there's some good thoughtful coverage here. One of the reporters was in a Target, I think, using Periscope to interview people and got booted out of Target, you know, again, with that same sort of fear about people getting filmed in public places. And you're right, Carrie, that I think people are going to have to wrap their heads around it, and that our societal mores around this are going to get attacked and have to undergo some maybe uncomfortable changes as technology continues enabling things that maybe people aren't wild about happening to them.
I think that's another issue having to do with the... it's been talked about with regard to rights of publicity, which is another, aside from the copyright issues that Periscope or Meerkat present. Rights of publicity are another issue. And that's essentially the right of individuals to control the commercial use of their identities. Individuals have, you know, as far as rights of privacy go, those rights are pretty limited in the context of a public sphere, but mm-hmm. rights of publicity, on the other hand, might still kind of come into play here. Some of the problems with rights of publicity are that they're state-based rights. So I think there are 38-ish states that have rights of publicity statutes, and then also the scope of rights of publicity is very different state to state, both in length and in substance. I think, you know, there are several states that end the right of publicity at death. And I think there's one state whose statute is drafted such that it looks like it only begins at death. So rights of publicity might come into play with some of this in a way that we haven't really seen that right applied before, because typically you think of rights of publicity as applying to celebrities who have a commercial value of their identity. But the more we take that commercial value and apply it to the masses, there's some really interesting questions that could come up here.
Megan, along those lines, what do you think will happen with the law around implied consent? Because while the privacy rights you mentioned, you know, pretty much go off the table if you're out and about in public, except in, you know, you're being filmed in ways that you wouldn't expect to be filmed. But the right of publicity rights do not. And how media companies deal with that, or anyone who wants to make a buck off their video, is they have people sign a media release, usually, if they're being careful. Do you think that implied consent will begin to develop as a result of these technologies?
I do think so. And I think it'll start to coalesce around, you know, the extent to which a person is featured in a video, or what is, you know, what is sold? Is it used in a commercial? I mean, there's some really easy sort of bright lines I think we could draw with regard to implied consent. But then there's that murky area in the center that I think could really be fleshed out here.
Right.
And you'd have to know they were streaming you, Denise, too. I mean, and somebody holding up their phone, they could be doing one of 100,000 things that don't involve live streaming. So I think until we're clear on that, it's impossible to consent impliedly or overtly until you know what's happening.
Yeah, that's right. What do you think, Zian? Do you think at some point just being out in public will these technologies will be so ubiquitous that courts will begin to think that people reasonably have to assume they might be being filmed?
I think so. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, with Google Glass and the ubiquitous use of cell phones out and about at major events like this, I don't think you would have a right as a private individual to challenge most of these uses, again, unless it's overtly commercial. But then again, more likely, you know, the NFL will have to deal with this more head on when they actually want to use snapshots of fans, of actual fans, in their commercials, right, at one of their games. So,
right. Okay. Well, this is definitely a story that's going to continue to develop, and we'll continue to keep an eye on it. But I'd like to pivot a bit and continue talking about the DMCA, but in another context. And that context is cars. So let's shift gears away from entertainment and more into copyright. We talked on a couple of shows ago about John Deere, the tractor company, arguing to the Copyright Office that all of the under-the-hood aspects of their machines are protected by copyright law, and the provisions of the DMCA that don't enable something that is locked up with a sufficiently encryption-level technology to be tampered with, except under very limited circumstances. That was on episode 300. And Sam Abuelsamid, who joined us not too long ago on the show and is a writer and specialist in automotive technologies, wrote to me and thought that really what's going on here, to paraphrase him, is that there's sort of an application of the DMCA. Maybe with John Deere, it's one thing. He says perhaps they're trying to protect their service and parts businesses. But when it comes to automakers, there's a concern that they have about their network security and making sure that their cars don't get hacked and become dangerous as a result and subject them to liability. And what they're trying to do is, because the DMCA is there and provides a structure to lock people out of the technologies in the car, they're basically taking a copyright law and using it for security purposes. And I thought that was an interesting take on it, and wanted to toss it out to you folks and see what you think about, specifically Megan, what you think about taking the DMCA and using it for a purpose that's really removed from protecting people's copyrights.
Yeah. Well, Section 1201 of the DMCA governs anti-circumvention of technological measures that protect copyrighted works. And that seems simple enough when it comes to, say, digital rights management, DRM of movies or something like that. But here in this issue, I think we're seeing a perfect technological storm, because the DMCA can now be applied with the Internet of Things in the far corners of our lives. Automobiles, tractors, appliances, because the bar to copyrightability is so low with originality and fixation, and that there's no requirement to register a copyright, and because software is protected as a copyrighted work, increasingly there are copyrighted works in everything. And so no one anticipated this. And what we're seeing now is a comment period. Every 3 years, the Copyright Office looks at exemptions to the DMCA. I think one of the things that's coming out here is this idea of IP maximization, that in an information and content economy, IP owners often see it not just as their right, but their obligation to maximize their IP assets, for better or worse. And sometimes the worst can come through public relations disasters and things like that. I think Facebook has seen some of that over time. But these automakers want to control the electronic control units in their cars. You know, they don't want users tinkering with them or repairing them or modifying the car. In some of their comments, they've said things like, it's too complex and dangerous to do. And that users, by doing that, could violate other laws, like other copyright laws, or even emission standards, which I found was really odd. But, you know, nothing in the DMCA regulates those things. And we have had ways of addressing these kinds of issues through voiding of warranties and things like that outside of the DMCA for a long time. I think, ironically, as the Electronic Frontier Foundation has pointed out, that, you know, people have been working with ECUs for a long time with results that have actually resulted in improved fuel efficiency and other sort of developments and innovations in the automotive industry. I think the other comment I would have is that really what you see in this IP maximization is that the automotive industry is looking for a new revenue model. That they see this, the personalization of vehicles, they see innovation happening, and they want to have a piece of it. They want to have a part of the software upgrades, and they want to control repairs. I think Ford in particular has perhaps filed suit on one of these issues in the last several months. And they argue that they know their cars better and that this is the safer option. And maybe that's the case, but it certainly seems like the automotive industry has failed in some significant cases lately to do something with that specialized knowledge and perhaps opening up the innovation like, you know, Elon Musk and Tesla has done could be a good thing.
Right. And there's a great piece by Thomas Fox Brewster at Forbes, who has some sources that he says he's 100% confident in the validity of his sources' comments, that even though Tesla is sort of backing away from this, that Tesla's taking sort of the opposite approach of trying to lock everything down, and that they're going to go to DEF CON with a car and, according to Thomas Fox Brewster's sources anyway, let the whole DEF CON audience have at it and hack the car, et cetera, and do their best or their worst. And that Tesla in general has been very proactive in recruiting people from events like DEF CON and the hacker community in general to bang on their cars and make sure that their security is as strong as it can be. So a different Absolutely. Sort of approach than trying to hide behind the DMCA. Sorry, who was chiming in?
No, I was just going to follow up and say that I agree with you. And I think that, you know, Elon Musk has had a history with Tesla of doing things in an unconventional way. I think it was last year around this time that they decided to open up all the patents that they have to the public for use, and said that they wouldn't enforce any of their patents against anyone who wants to use Tesla's technology. And that might at first blush seem really generous, but I think it's also just a pretty good business model. I mean, the more people that you have innovating on the Tesla platform, the more people you have interacting in that space, the greater market for Teslas.
Yeah. Yeah. And they might have an opportunity. I don't know, you know, if their safety and products liability lawyers would let them do it. But as Reverb Mike points out in our IRC chat, but I'm hacking my car to make it better, he says. And there might be, you know, a whole bunch of people who want to overclock their cars and try and do improvements, et cetera. But again, I don't know. Zian, what do you think? I think the chances that something could go wrong and that the car company that let people hack their cars to make them better might be in for quite a few lawsuits coming their way when things went awry.
Yeah, I think because it's such a new field, it's just hard to tell at this point. I mean, especially because people do expect automated vehicles to be on the road as a regular thing in the next decade. You know, people, they're going to be hackers anyway. So I guess the question is going to be, you know, the number of test cases that actually appear in courts and see. It's completely possible that, you know, a court could find that if you actually, in fact, tamper with your car in the same way that if you unlock your iPhone, then the manufacturer, you know, ceases to have certain responsibilities for malfunctions or the way it works. But I actually think it's interesting because by locking down the technology, as I said, hackers are going to come. So if they do hack a system remotely and something does go wrong, the question may be, well, you know, did you car company who purposefully attempted to secure your network, was it secure enough? And so I'm sure we'll expect to see some lawsuits like that coming up in the future.
Well, we're going to talk more about Tesla in just a minute here. But before we do, I'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. It's amazing how many lawyers I know who spend too much time practicing paperwork rather than practicing law. On top of their piles of affidavits and case files, there's billable hours that need tracking, expenses to manage, and client invoices to prepare and send. FreshBooks can make your life a little easier. I use FreshBooks in my practice, and it definitely makes my life easier. It in fact, enables me to have a solo practice where I don't have to have employees or the overhead involved, and yet I can accurately track my time and expenses and generate the reports that I need for my own business purposes and get myself paid from my clients. It's very easy, very professional. That's what I really like about it is it is definitely top of the line as far as presentation and professionalism. And you can choose whether if you have clients who are very old school and like to get things in the mail and like to file things away, you can go that way. But you can also go the email route, which I find that more and more of my clients prefer. And it does seem to expedite things as well. When you're sending out an invoice by email, it can't just sit in a pile on somebody's desk and not get paid attention to. It's going to save you time billing. It's going to get you paid faster. Its invoices are really, they just come together in minutes. You can also track your time if you're a professional who needs to do that. And you can do that with your phone. There's a mobile app to track your billable hours from anywhere. And the FreshBooks mobile apps help you organize receipts while you're running around between the office, client meetings, the courthouse, as you're incurring expenses that need to be captured and billed out. That's very easy to do with the mobile app as well. And if you do have questions about using the product, about anything that's just confusing to you at all, I've never had any part of the service be confusing, but if something comes up, there is the award-winning FreshBooks supports team waiting to help you out. There's a real-life person on the other end of that phone when you give them a call, which is always welcome. Getting started is simple and it's totally free for 30 days with no obligation. Go to freshbooks.com/twill and don't forget to enter twill when they ask you how you heard about them. That helps us out quite a bit. We appreciate you doing that. You can start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for supporting this episode of This Week in Law. All right, Tesla is kind of all over our rundown for today and has been making some waves in the Texas legislature, where there are some laws pending or attempting to be gotten through that involve how Tesla does business in that state. So let's talk about the policy concerns that Tesla's facing. So Tesla, like many other companies before it, would like very much to be able to sell directly to the consumers in Texas, to cut out the middleman, to disintermediate the dealer, like lots of companies do. Apple comes to mind. Amazon comes to mind. Tesla, however, doesn't come to mind if you're in Texas, because it's against the law to sell cars in Texas if they're not sold through a dealership. Megan, you've been paying attention to this. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yes, I think that this is a situation where the particular industry has such lobbying power that Tesla's having a really hard time entering markets in many states. I think West Virginia has also just passed a law in the last month or two saying that Tesla could not sell directly to consumers using its distribution model, that it had to go through the classic car dealership model, which is quite unfortunate, because you know it's almost the classic car dealership model is such a dinosaur in and of itself, and kind of a miserable user experience for many people, almost a metaphor itself. But but Tesla is really trying to kind of counteract this resistance state by state with mixed success. I think the powerful lobbies in the Texas legislature have created an inhospitable environment for Tesla. And I did an op-ed in the Austin American Statesman, and unfortunately, that didn't sway the legislature.
So it looks as though the laws that Tesla had been hoping would go through are a bit stalled in the Texas legislature. You don't see any light on the horizon for Tesla on this front?
Well, there's, I'm cautiously optimistic, but mainly because the Texas legislature has so many controversial issues that it's dealing with right now, that maybe this will seem like the less controversial of, including issues like if kids can have guns on campuses and things like that. So, right. So we'll have to just see kind of as time goes on, but, there's no predicting what happens in the state legislature in Texas sometimes.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by this, Carrie, that there are states where it's actually against the law to sell a car without a dealer. Any thoughts on it?
I have a lot of thoughts on it. The first is that people are going to do what they want. I'm sort of like, I just think the Texas legislature needs to be more like the cool mom who's like, look, if your kids are going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house. Like Like, fine, if you have to regulate that process for selling cars, regulate it to protect the consumer, but don't ban it when it's clearly the direction in which a lot of people want to go. It's just shooting yourself in the foot. You're passing laws that people are going to try to work around. And that's really not the goal, I think, of representatives that are elected by the people. It's just counterproductive.
As things stand now, you know, Tesla cars are very widely respected and much sought after. Just sort of anecdotally, I seem to see them around more than I see BMWs around now. They're sort of sliding into that niche, as far as I can tell. People want them, and it seems like if aside from the fact that they're great for the environment, throw that in as well as the drive and the status of the thing.
I mean, if you make it too difficult, they'll just go to Oklahoma and get it and drive it back to Texas. And then you've lost, right, you know, whatever tax money you were going to have on it. So, yeah, it's a bad idea all around.
Yep. Zian, do you
give
agree?
Give people what they want.
Oh, yeah, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, obviously, if I can get a Tesla and potentially save a couple thousand dollars on it, that would, I'd love that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's stick with talking about Tesla and car technology for a moment. Cars are becoming more and more autonomous. Of course, here in California, you might bump into one that's driving around on its own, but that's still a bit pie in the sky. But what automakers are doing are starting to build more technologies in that incrementally have cars driving themselves more and more. And one thing that lawmakers just don't quite know what to do with are making cars hands-free in certain situations. So let's talk about those automatic cars. I want my car driven by that robot right there, for sure. So several automakers, Tesla among them, Cadillac, Mercedes, others are working on or already have technologies for cars to drive themselves in certain situations, for the drivers to take their hands off the wheel for periods of time on straight stretches of road. California and Nevada are both working on laws that would regulate that technology. It seems to be a completely wide open area as far as the legality of it. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it can't preempt automakers from doing this until something goes wrong, until something has been demonstrated as unsafe. So it's going to be left in the United States to the 50 states to decide what they think is safe and try and walk that balance line between allowing innovation and automation in ways that improves everybody's life, but encouraging safety as well. Carrie, are you ready to jump into your hands-free car?
I am. I think there's every chance that hands-free cars are going to drive more safely and abide by the law more routinely than people do. I think that's pretty obvious. Like, they see a yellow light, they slow down. I see a yellow light. I think I have a couple seconds to make it before it turns red, you know? So I think if you're looking at the larger societal goal of safer driving, then maybe some states would want to regulate, you know, who can create these cars, what's required, that sort of oversight, inspection maybe. But I don't know that they'd want to outright ban them, knowing that there's every chance they'll actually make the roads safer.
Zian, do you have any thoughts on this?
So I know that it was reported that Uber has said that they're going to replace their fleet of cars with automated cars in the next 10 years, which, you know, would save them a lot of money because their drivers take home a large portion of the revenue. But I guess I'm curious about that because in a situation where you, as the driver in an automated vehicle, presumably you would still be expected to make the right choice if, you know, if there's a girl crossing the road and, you know, you can either choose to veer to miss her, but maybe severely injure yourself, or, you know, that's the kind of decision that I'm just not sure how the computer is going to make that choice. You know, the classic tort example of, you know, would you choose to save yourself, or, you know, but if you had to run into an oncoming car with three school children inside, I mean, these are, you know, it's, human decision-making isn't perfect, but I just wonder, you know, who's going to take the fall in situations where there's an automated computer involved. And, you know, with Uber automated cars, I feel like, for example, I, for one, can't drive. So I basically rely on Uber to get me around the city everywhere. And I don't know if I would feel completely comfortable in an automated car where there's just not, there's not that element of human interaction and decision-making involved.
I've seen some sketchy Uber drivers. I'd be okay with less human interaction.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, Carrie, is that, you know, Uber has its own host of legal troubles, both, you know, battling a similar kind of war as Tesla, trying to do business in its own efficient way that might conflict with laws that date back 50 years to protect a business that maybe does not need protecting anymore. So aside from its regulatory concerns, it also, it has concerns about, you know, the thoroughness of its background checks, and people tend to look a little bit warily at their Uber driver as they jump in, and there have been stories about some bad things happening. So maybe this, you know, automatic cars for Uber, maybe that solves at least some of their PR and legal woes.
Well, some of them, but at the same time, they're, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, at the same time, they're taking away their biggest proponents, the drivers, who, well, mm-hmm. and the people who want the service. So now you're alienating the drivers who are part of your vocal outcry against these antiquated laws. So I'm not so sure that that was a good move, but, you know, cat's out of the bag. You can't really say, you know, it's cool, don't worry about it. We're just, forget that.
Yes,
forget that. Just get this law passed now. We'll talk about that later.
Right. Zian, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, I just wonder on an ancillary point, you know, where the liability is going to go in this situation. With an Uber car, and is it your fault? Is the only passenger in the car when you saw something coming and the computer somehow glitched or missed it? Was it your fault that you didn't step in to try to, you know, stop the oncoming collision?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how those laws develop and where the responsibilities are going to be placed. Who's, you know, I'm sure the insurance carriers will have a lot to say about it, and whether
that's that's come up in a lot of contexts, like even texting while driving or distracted driving. Mm-hmm. In some states, they want to hold liable the people who know that you're driving and text you anyway. So they're extending liability in some instances to those people. I think you'll see the same thing here, where if there's, you know, negligence to go around, they'll divvy it up. If you even have the mechanism as a passenger to have input into the route or the actions of the car, that's something we don't know yet.
Right. We have a couple of great trademark experts on the show with us today. So we're going to talk about a couple of those issues as well next, but I think I'll put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in for people who are listening to the show and applying for continuing legal or other professional education credit. Our first phrase is going to be automated Uber, and we'll put another one in before the end of the show. And if you need some more information about that or interested in more information about continuing legal or other professional education credit for the show, head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv and find our show page there. And you'll find information, at least in the United States, that could give you a hand. So let's talk about trademark. There have been some really interesting trademark stories and cases in the news lately, particularly the Redskins come to mind. There is a tendency or actual legal requirements that trademarks that are offensive or scandalous are not supposed to be registered. But it turns out to be a real hard judgment to make, and you wind up with some very difficult, strange results. So why don't we start with Megan? I know that you've done a survey of scandalous trademarks. First, tell us what makes a trademark scandalous.
If I had the answer to that, then I wouldn't have had to do the scholarship I'm working on.
Right.
It's incredibly difficult to figure out what is scandalous or immoral. The Lanham Act, which is the federal trademark statute, prevents registration of marks that are scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. And when it comes to scandalous and immoral marks, we go by a definition of scandalousness from the 1938 dictionary, which hasn't changed that much over time, but it says things like shocking to the conscience, a moral outrage, offensive to the core. And so when you have this question, you have trademark examiners at the trademark office who are looking at trademark applications and deciding on their own whether or not a particular application is for a mark that is scandalous or immoral, and they have a really hard time doing that. They're supposed to consider whether a mark is scandalous in the context of the marketplace. And what ends up happening is typically in, I think, 90% of cases, you see trademark examiners just looking in the dictionary. And if it says offensive or vulgar next to the word, then that's used as primary evidence to reject the mark. But that doesn't take into account the context of the marketplace. So for example, when it comes to, you know, adult entertainment goods, or, you know, alcohol or different things like that, in a particular marketplace, a mark might not be scandalous with those consumers on those goods and services. And dictionaries don't really take that into account. What you see is the trademark examiners saying, if it's in an adult marketplace, they'll say, ooh, it's an adult marketplace, therefore it must be scandalous. And then they'll say, if it's in a general marketplace, ooh, this is an offensive word used in a general marketplace, and therefore it's scandalous. So you see a lot of rejections for words that don't really quite make sense, and a lot of inconsistency in these types of decisions.
Right. And the Washington Redskins in particular have been much in the news and are attempting to challenge the law that has left them without their trademark, correct?
That's partly correct. So to have a trademark, you really just need to use a word or symbol or anything as a brand, and you don't have to register it. So registration is just an added benefit. You get certain benefits by registering your mark that you wouldn't have otherwise. So the Redskins are able to still maintain their mark as an unregistered mark. But they aren't able to have those added benefits for registration. And that's as a result of the disparagement provision of the Lanham Act, which says that trademarks can't be registered if they're disparaging to a substantial composite of a particular group of people.
Right. Have you paid attention? This was written up in Parker Higgins and Sarah Zhang's wonderful newsletter, which is called Five Useful Articles. There was a case just decided that was called In Re Simon Shao Tam, also known as the Slants case, because this seems like something that the Redskins could potentially argue that, hey, you know, we need to alter the law here because there should be opportunities for people to call themselves what they want. Dykes on Bikes would be another example. Or in this case, it involved an Asian American dance rock band called the Slants, who were unable to register their trademark because it was disparaging under the law that we're talking about. Their lawyer, Ron Coleman, is attempting to argue that this is the reappropriation of a term usually considered a slur, and that we want to allow folks to be able to do that. It's actually a speech issue. So I'm wondering if you have paid attention to that case and if you think it adds a different texture to the discussion.
It absolutely does. This case has the potential to change everything in this with this regard to this provision of the law. What happened was Simon filed a trademark application noting that they were an Asian American band, and then it was rejected because of disparagement, and then he refiled without any mention of his Asian American heritage. And in that context, one of the primary issues that they were arguing before the Federal Circuit was that, you know, how much these trademark examiners can go outside the four corners of the application, which I think presents an interesting question. What the Federal Circuit said in an opinion that has now been vacated, they upheld the disparagement rejection because it doesn't matter whether or not someone is using it. I mean, under trademark law, it doesn't matter whether someone's using it in a way that's reappropriating or empowering a particular part of the language, but it matters what the general public thinks. So if the general public, a substantial composite of the general public, finds it disparaging, then they're going to reject the application. And so I think that there's several problems with that. I mean, it doesn't take into account kind of some of the fluidity of language and issues of social justice. But that's the legal standard. The Federal Circuit vacated its opinion a week later and instead now is going to hear the case on bank. And when it hears the case, it's limiting its hearing to the constitutionality issue. So it has asked the parties to rebrief the case on whether or not Lanham Act Section 2A, preventing registration of disparaging marks, violates the Constitution.
Oh, wow.
And if that's the case, and Judge Moore in the opinion really kind of set up the argument for against the constitutionality of that provision, if that's the case, then that changes everything for the Redskins.
Wow, that's going to be really interesting to see what happens there. Zian, a couple of questions for you, since trademark is your area of expertise as well, or one of your many areas of expertise. Number one, the standard that Megan was just outlining there, where you would somehow have to know how the public perceived the use of the mark in order to make a determination whether it's disparaging or not. Do you think that that's workable at all? How do you see that working?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. I think in the Slants case, it was a really sympathetic sympathetic plaintiff, if you will. It was a great story of reappropriation. But of course, if you get rid of the disparagement of 2A, then it kind of opens up a whole Pandora's box of there could be people, dykes on bikes, for example, that seek to take aim at a stereotype, but then there could simply be other people who just want to create federally register no insert racial slur allowed. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like the perception of the public would really differ whether or not you think you're reappropriating a term or not. Maybe Simon Tam thinks that being in a band called The Slants gives him some power over this racial slur, but the general public, as a matter of course, may not perceive that or may not agree, and so it is hard to sort of appropriately contextualize the right audience and which consumer you're asking. But I do understand that actually a large portion of Judge Moore's opinion that was subsequently vacated, the second half of her opinion where she advocated for alternate views, and that was where she put forth the constitutional argument. She argued that it was an unconstitutional condition, a violation of First Amendment rights to require, to abridge someone's freedom of speech in order to get the extra benefits associated with federal registration. I do believe that was actually in large part mimicking the briefing that had already been filed in the Redskins case in the Eastern District of Virginia. So I know that they are, it's momentous, and I think everyone is excited to find out what happens.
Yeah. What, if you had to guess how you think the constitutionality argument will come out, what do you think?
It's hard. I mean, the fact that, this is commercial speech and it would be entitled to less protection than purely political speech, for example. And obviously you do, you are able to still use the mark in commerce, just not have the federal registration and the couple of extra benefits that come with that. And of course, trademark examiners deny registrations on a number of reasons, right? That's not just limited to 2A. Of course, if they perceive that your mark is likely to cause confusion in the marketplace, and the appeals board agrees with them, then yeah, you don't get a federal registration. You may have to go out and in the end, do some kind of corporate deal where you buy the mark that you have really been wanting to use. And maybe someone is just using that mark in a small shop in Brooklyn, and you are you're a huge company and you think, you think you have the right to use it, maybe in the end you don't get a registration. You have to go out and buy that registration. I know that Skype has actually denied European registration for their mark, I think just recently, maybe this week. So, which is, of course, citing confusion with British telecom company Sky. So, which is, yeah, and I've never heard of Sky, and everyone knows what Skype is here. So, yeah, I think trademark registration could be done a number of reasons. And, the Redskins issue definitely highlights sort of the emotional stakes here for a lot of people. A lot of people who obviously take great offense to the validation of this mark. So.
Right. You know, one of the interesting differences between this provision in Section 2A and other bases for rejection is that most of those bases for rejection impact a trademark's ability to function as a trademark. So when it comes to likelihood of confusion or deception, if Burger King could put up the golden arches and attract consumers that way, or, Taco Bell could use Chipotle on their sign, then that would create a likelihood of confusion in the marketplace and would deceive consumers potentially. So a lot of the basis for rejection for registration has to do with that function of trademarks as a consumer protection device. And the interesting aspect of these particular provisions in 2A is that they aren't related to the core function of trademarks. One very interesting thing in Judge Moore's opinion was that she was talking about this idea of unregistered marks and mentioned it, as I have historically understood trademark law to operate, Section 43A in the Lanham Act allows people to enforce unregistered marks. And so even though your mark may not be registered for whatever reason, you can still enforce it. And so a lot of the controversy after the Redskins decision, trademark scholars were kind of saying it's not that big of a deal because they're still going to be able to enforce their mark and they're not going to have a registration, but that's, has some limited benefits.
Right.
One of the things that came out of this particular opinion was Judge Moore said that 43A should only allow the enforcement of trademarks that are capable of being registered as trademarks, which might mean that marks rejected for whatever reason, but under 2A, particularly including the Redskins, wouldn't be able to be enforced as marks at all. Mm-hmm. And so if that's the case, then all of a sudden, those benefits you get from federal registration look a lot more substantive and present a bigger problem, I think, for constitutionality.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, we will have to see how this comes out. And it's so great to have your insights and explanations about all this because it's a bit of a thicket. So we really appreciate that. I think we're going to move on and shift over another thing that Carrie does on her blog or has a couple of instances in addition to write about live streaming and the legalities of that. She has some great resources about if you're running a contest or a giveaway and the laws that apply to that as well. So since those tend to be rise and fall on how their terms of service are laid out, let's talk about them in that context. So, Carrie, one of your headlines is online giveaways, just because Rafflecopter lets you do it doesn't make it legal. And I think you've hit on something that's a pet peeve of mine, that there can be a disconnect between the tools that people crank out because there's a need for them. And we want to automate things. We want to make it easy for people to run their promotion, et cetera. But the lawyers working with the tool makers might not always thoroughly understand the law. Can you tell us exactly what you were getting at there in that piece?
Sure. What happened was I'd presented to a number of blogger groups who were using giveaways routinely to promote their sites and not appreciating the fact that there is a distinction between, say, contests and giveaways versus illegal lotteries. They were just doing things because they had the mechanism to do it no consideration as to whether or not it was legal. And so what would happen is I would give a presentation and explain the differences and why they mattered and how they could keep themselves safe. And they said, but Rafflecopter lets me do this. Raffle.org lets me do this. You know what? In other words, it was kind of this paternalistic idea that Rafflecopter cares about you. And I was like, Rafflecopter doesn't care about you. Like, if you dig into, they just don't. If you dig into the terms of service, they make it very clear. You use this at your own risk of liability. You're supposed to know the law where you are. And the law in each state is different. The law in each country is different. So some of these blogs reach all over the world. But if they don't specify who can enter these contests or giveaways, they're liable for violations of the law potentially in Canada or other countries. Like in Canada, you're not permitted to win anything based on chance. There has to be an element of skill to it. And these guys, they had never even considered that. And there was like a minor freak out. But I think once they understood that just because you've got the mechanism to do something doesn't mean it's legal where you are, they at least understood that maybe they should be thinking about that, which I think was something that they had just completely backburnered. Like, Rafflecopter must have checked this out. It must be okay. Like, somehow they could disable on the back end how you use the tool. Like, oh, you're in Florida. You can't use that kind of giveaway. No. Right. Not only do they not care, they expressly put the liability onto the users.
Yes. It's something people need to be aware of, that just because tools are out there and available and say, hey, you know, here, we're going to run that for you, just use our service. Right. You still
and
need to.
Just because, yeah. Of course. And just because a certain social network is a great fit for your audience, gives you great reach and exposure, and your contest or giveaway is a success on the basis of it accomplishes whatever business goal you have, it could still be in violation of the terms, even of that social network. And you could lose the benefit that you've gained from spending all these months building up your presence there. So it really is something they should consider a potentially huge risk. So at least I'm happy that some people have seen that article and have come to me after and said, oh, thank you. You just saved me from running what I now know would have been an illegal lottery. I'm like,
right. And Carrie has another great article called How to Keep Your Social Media Contest from Becoming a Trial, which has similar kinds of warnings and considerations in it. The related thing that I've seen in my own practice is services that are out there that attempt to, again, they're sort of contest-oriented services, and they attempt to have you form an enforceable contract with the entrants, but they haven't paid sufficient attention to the law on that front either. So, you know, in some cases, the terms of service aren't, you know, apparent or something that, you know, there are lots of cases out there that say that if they're not right there and the party's not on notice, that you haven't even formed a contract, and their mechanism for forming the contract is not sufficiently rigorous, and certain things are checked by default that really should be checked by the user and that kind of thing. So people should keep an eye out for those kinds of pitfalls when they're using services to try and run their promotions and contests and things online.
There are things that aren't even contemplated, not even remotely, by any of these tools or sites. Like, some states have bonding requirements. If you're going to have a giveaway or even a contest and the prize is over a certain amount in value, you have to register it. You have to insure it. And they have no idea. Or if it's over a certain amount, you have to notify the IRS at the end of the year that the person has won this prize and that they're therefore subject to income tax. And all these things that go well beyond even the scope of any contract that some of these tools would purport to create. If they even, let's just say that it was valid, which I don't think in many instances they are, you've got a lot of things that are not covered that would need to be covered.
Right. So I think, you know, in honor of the fact that we highlighted your live streaming legality piece last week as a resource of the week, we have to make those two pieces we just mentioned two of our resources of the week this week. I'm going to give you one more, and that is a book that I'm reading and really enjoying. And I kind of wanted to pick Zian's brain about it too. I wonder if you've read it. It's by Dana Boyd. It's called It's Complicated. It's about teens and social media. And the poor thing, poor Dana, you know, she's writing this book in 2012 and 2013, and already the social media landscape has changed so much that it seems kind of anachronistic. She goes to great lengths to say, now, some of the things I talk about in this book, you're going to think just aren't even being used anymore, but that's okay, because the principles I'm talking about still apply to whatever tools you're using today. And I think that that's true. She, this is from the Amazon page, she explores tropes about identity, privacy, safety, danger, and bullying. Ultimately, Boyd argues that society fails young people when paternalism and protectionism hinder teenagers' ability to become informed, thoughtful, and engaged citizens through their online interactions. And Zian, I wondered if you had paid attention to this, because I know you've, there's a great piece out there. We haven't really had time to touch on it in the show today, but it's called The Future Belongs to the Uninhibited. And Zian, you were one of the featured, you know, future facing youngsters in that, in New York Magazine. You've done some great writing too on teens and sexting. So I just wondered if this had popped up on your radar and if you'd had any thoughts.
Yeah, I definitely did. It's on my to-read list. But it's funny that you bring up the article in connection with this, because that article was written and I was interviewed when I was 19 and a freshman in college. And needless to say, I've completely changed my views on this. You know, the article was meant to be a celebration of the uninhibited online. I was a very outspoken advocate for that. And actually in my teen sexting Law Review article, I footnoted a part where I basically disclaim all my views that were published in New York Magazine. And I think, you know, there's a cognitive element to this. Obviously, a lot of recent scientific, you know, research has uncovered the fact that your brain is just not fully matured until you're in your late 20s. And teenagers are impulsive and don't lack the full set of skills for adult decision making. I don't think I would have opted to be in that article today. So I felt something. I do think there is so much out there right now about just the dangers of cyberbullying and the consequences on both ends of the victim and of the bully. So, you know, and in my article, which is much too long to go into now, but it does talk about sort of the two different models that the Supreme Court has used to adjudicate these adolescent free speech cases, right? That, you know, sort of the inculcation model, where it is our job as adult society to put the right values in our children, and sort of the free thinker model, in which that, you know, we want to encourage children to think for themselves. And ultimately, I come down in the article to the opinion that it's just a matter of what kind of speech it is. So if you're engaging in political speech, it's more likely to be protected. And if you're engaging in, obviously, sexting, anything that's image-based, closer to the end of pornography, and obviously hate speech, fighting words, things like that, then it would less likely be protected for minors.
Great. And again, if you want to read Zian's whole article, and I think you should, great thoughts there on a complicated issue. That and everything else we've discussed today are in our delicious links for this episode. And you've given me, I think, our second MCLE passphrase for the show, Zian, and it's going to be ignore what I said before. So for folks who need to verify that they watched or listened to the show, that'll be our second phrase for you. We have a tip of the week for you. It has to do with Freedom of Information Act requests. I thought it would be interesting for folks to know how long they can expect to wait if they file a Freedom of Information Act request for publicly available government information. And that wait has been increasing. In fact, from the year 2013 to 2014, there was a doubling, at least, of the backlog in Freedom of Information Act requests, probably, I'm guessing, related to the concerns and handwriting over everything that Edward Snowden brought to light, that we might be able to correlate those two things, although I really don't know. But some interesting stats on Freedom of Information Act requests now that the backlog is increasing. In the case of easy, sort of simple requests, you might wait as few as 21 days. But there are some pending, unresolved Freedom of Information Act requests that go all the way back to 1993 or 1995. So you might wait 20 or more years, too. So just bear in mind that patience would be a good thing if you're going to file a FOIA request. And you also might want to bear in mind, too, the article that I read on this also had the cost to the government of the filing of all these requests, roughly $400 million a year. So make sure you really need that information. It's probably a good idea because it's going to be slow and it's costing quite a bit these days to respond to all the requests.
I love that we're going to come down on Ustream for taking 48 hours. When you want something from the government, they're like, what? Be patient. What? Get to
1993. Excellent point. All right. Well, I think we have managed to get through everything we're going to get through this week for This Week in Law. I've really, really enjoyed our panel. Great thoughts and insights from you all. Megan Carpenter from Texas A&M University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Denise. It was a blast.
Megan, is there anything going on at your university or on your speaking schedule? Anything in particular you want to highlight before we go ahead and wrap the show?
Sure. You know, interestingly, we have just hired through, I direct our Center for Law and Intellectual Property, and we have just hired four and maybe five. We're doing the last, hopefully get the good word in the next few days, IP professors in addition to the faculty we already have, which I think is more intellectual property professors than any university has hired at once in the history of U.S. legal education, I think. So, we are building out our intellectual property program. We have three clinics. We are planning conferences for next year on a variety of kind of cutting edge topics. And so we are just looking forward to a great future through the IP program at Texas A&M.
Thanks. That's great news. Good to hear. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us as well from Marketing Smarts and What Marketers Need to Know. Anything that's coming up for you that you want to highlight for folks?
Yeah, I'll be speaking at Yale Connect in Birmingham, Alabama, which is an event for marketing professionals. More about Meerkat. That's actually the basis of my presentation, Meerkat Periscope live streaming and the legality of that, and another presentation on contests. So I'll be able to get into more depth here. I didn't want to make everybody sit through the whole thing, you know, but it would have been good for a dry run, but I think very boring for your... for your viewers to have to sit through unexpectedly. So,
all right. Well, they our viewers can go seek you out if they need more information on those fronts.
And I'm on Twitter at Carrie Gorgone.
There we go. Gorgone. Oh, and I meant to ask Megan, I couldn't find you on Twitter. Are you on Twitter? We usually highlight people's Twitter addresses.
I am. They have Megan one. Carpenter.
Megan Carpenter. There we go. Yeah. Thank you for letting us know. And Zian, lawyer at Arndt Fox, busy practice. Anything else going on you want to highlight for folks?
I just want to put in a plug. I'm a visiting fellow also at the Yale Law School Information Society Project, which is Yale's IP center. And we're doing really great things right now, working on the Ninth Circuit pre-1972's case, which I know has also been a hot topic these days. So looking forward to that.
Very cool. Yes, the Yale ISP has been doing good work for so many years, and it's great to know that they're involving such smart people in their ongoing work today. It's been really wonderful having you all on the show, and it's been wonderful having you all join us in the audience. If you've done so Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, that means you joined us live. Yay, thank you for doing that. We love it when you join us live, but you don't have to. Of course, our works, unlike things that are live streamed through Periscope and Meerkat and other services, ours are going to be around for a really, really long time. And if you go to twit.tv/twill, you'll find our whole archive of shows going all the way back to 2006. So you can check that out at your leisure. We're also on YouTube. We have a page there that is youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. And you should get in touch with me and my co-host Sarah, who couldn't be with us here this week, but we'll be back next week between the shows by either finding us on social media. We have a Facebook page and a Google Plus page. I'm D Howell on Twitter. That's a great way to get us suggestions, topics, stories that have caught your eye that you think should catch ours. You can also email me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Sarah is sarahp@twit.tv. So we love to hear from you however you get in touch with us. We're really glad that you've joined us, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law.